Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgThentic Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. There's nothing like starting off a conversation with a provocative statement, which is exactly what our next guest, Gabrielle Chen, has done with the title of her new book. Gabby is a journalist and author, and she's just started as the rural and regional editor at The Guardian in Australia. She also lives on a farm in New South Wales.
The bottom line of the book is really that idea that farming and agriculture is exposed to all of these existential problems that the world is trying to work out. You know, where we go on climate change, how we use water more efficiently, soil loss, zoonotic diseases, all of these issues agriculture is very exposed to. So the world's problems are agriculture's problems, I think, like no other industry in some ways.
Gabby's book is called Why You Should Give an F About Farming. Of course, if you're listening to this podcast, it probably means you already do. But it's a good reminder to all of us involved in ag tech and agriculture that the average person, or eater, as Gabby calls them, is definitely not as aware of what actually happens in food and ag as we might wish them to be. So how do we make people how do we make them care about farming? Even Gabby didn't really appreciate the importance and interconnectedness of ag until she found herself on a farm.
I was a political journalist, so I grew up in suburban Sydney and went into the media and made my way to political reporting. But it was only when I met a farmer, when was it? In the 90s. And as things got more serious, I moved to the farm in 1996. And really, I still stayed fairly focused on politics for a long time. And the farm just sort of went on around me. I was still, you know, working as a working journalist, and we had kids. And so I'm a slow learner, I guess. It took a long time for it to seep into me and to realize that this was actually a really incredibly interesting industry and one that is exposed to a lot of things.
Yeah. What was it like, the original decision to move to the farm? Like, was that an easy or challenging decision to make?
Well, Sarah, you know, love is just a weird thing, isn't it? And so I didn't really have a moment where I thought, holy shit, should I be doing this? I just sort of dived in. I'm a bit of a survivor in the sense that, you know, some people are really connected to place, and I hadn't had that connection. So it didn't bother me that much. I think it was a worry for my family because my dad's from Singapore and, you know, a Chinese Singaporean migrant. And so he had nothing, no sort of references for rural life at all. And so I think he was possibly a bit worried. He asked me if I'd seen Wake and Fright, and I said, it's not like that, Dad. So I think it didn't bother me at the time, but it was a serious transition. It was hard at times, no doubt.
I'm sure. And I'm keen to hear more about that. Like what you said before was that it took you a while to sort of go from the farm is happening around you to getting involved. How did that happen?
So I am still largely not involved, and I refer to it in the book as, you know, this is wholly, solely my husband's thing. My interest as a political journalist, I guess, is around the policy questions that impinge on ag and how that works for the industry, I guess, and the communities as a whole as it's affected. But the transition, I think, was more as political debates changed and started to really examine things like climate change. My reporting was taking me along the Murray-Darling Basin, and so there were real fractures that I was seeing around irrigation and water debates more generally. And all of these things were making their way into the political process. So, you know, in the 2019 election, the reporting that I did was about very rusted on conservative communities shaking up the way they vote. And I was seeing political battles in some seats for the first time in forever. And I thought, really, I've got to look at this more seriously and try and get under the bonnet of what's happening in agriculture because it's impinging on politics.
Sure. I would say, though, I mean, my experience has been that outsiders like myself and yourself coming into ag can bring certainly different perspectives and hopefully sometimes interesting and helpful perspectives. What were some of your initial reactions and experiences having come from a city background?
Well, so the whole economic signals situation in ag really surprised me, I guess. The kind of middle family farmer, I guess, and that's very much kind of, I guess, where we stand. And so, you know, I'm very open about that, that that's the perspective I come from. So I don't see the very small end and I don't see the very large end. But that sort of economic squeeze and the economic signals that say you only get a pay rise based on yield, largely, if you're a commodity producer, that really surprised me. The loss of, I guess, R&D, research and development. And as I got more interested in farming, I was sort of asking around, like, where can I learn about this? Is there an extension officer that I can bring out to the place to ask what to do about this gully that keeps washing, or how to look at soil or do soil tests? Like, all of that infrastructure, as I learned in the research of the book, but also, you know, in dealing with some issues on farm, it really surprised me that that wasn't there, because I'd heard that it was there previously and now that's changed. And if you're the average age of an average farmer in Australia, which is late 50s, and I'm 55, you probably, unlike me, you probably did your ag science or ag echoes or, you know, your certificates and training, what, 30, 40 years ago. How do you keep up with this incredibly dynamic sector that is changing literally by the day? Some of the interviews I did for the book were just, it felt like they might be outdated, you know, 3 months down the track when we went to publication. And no one sees that more than you, right? You can see that happening. And so that all of those things really interested me.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the book then. So why don't you tell us about the title of the book?
The title of the book is Why You Should Give an F About Farming.
Right. And what motivated you to write the book?
The motivation was the last book I wrote was Rusted Off in 2018, and that was very much about the politics of rural communities and why I saw that changing. But there was only one chapter in there about agriculture, and I covered a couple of things that I'd seen, you know, hit the political debates, and one of those was climate change, and another was land usage fights between, say, farming and mining, and that whole argument about how we use land and who determines what land is used for. And then, as I say, the elections rolled on, 2019 came, water shortages became a big issue because we were in the middle of a roaring drought in the eastern states. And so I thought, I have to look at this further. Like, I have to think about whether this is the old industry that started white economy in Australia riding off the back of sheep and is now a quaint little cottage industry, which is sometimes how it's presented in mainstream debates, or whether it is actually still quite central to, you know, the way we think about ourselves as a nation, but for different reasons. So the question I formulated in my head was why you should give a fig about farming, or whether indeed you should, because I might find that with lab-grown food and vertical farms in cities and all these different other ways to produce food, I might find that, you know what, we don't have to worry about farming. Maybe that's all done and gone and we'll just kind of limp on into the future. But in fact, I found the exact opposite for reasons I outline in the book.
Yeah, and it ends up being a bit of a call to action that, you know, all of us, whether we're consumers or eaters, as you call them, and live in cities, do, you know, need to think more about our food. Tell me, at least at a high level, where you end up and maybe what was surprising about that.
So the bottom line of the book is really that idea that farming and agriculture is exposed to all of these existential problems that the world is trying to work out, you know, where we go on climate change, how we use water more efficiently and how we will cope with water shortages in the future, soil loss, zoonotic diseases. We're in the middle of a pandemic that may have come out of a wet market. All of these issues, agriculture is very exposed to. So the world's problems are agriculture's problems, I think, like no other industry in some way. Then we go into this live experiment with the pandemic where we see food disappear from shelves for sort of complex supply chain reasons. And so I worked my way through that, but also went back because I'm in my 50s. I began looking at politics in the 80s with the Hawke-Keating government in Australia and I guess the rise of a kind of market-first ideology. Some people refer to it as neoliberalism, but sort of annoys me that term because it pushes you into left and right camps. So this kind of market-first ideology that rises, that the market is the natural system, that if everything else, all the other regulation was taken away, we are left with this natural market system and that always produces the best outcomes. And so I just wanted to look at that and reanalyze that and have a think about what happened in that process. And my contention is that, you know, somewhere in that arc from the 80s to now, there was a sweet spot. And sometimes in market systems, we throw the baby out with the bathwater because we assume that all players are on a level playing field when they're clearly not. I mean, these are not deregulated markets. These, for me, are re-regulated markets because every free trade agreement has conditions. Every market has conditions and regulations and legislations. The free water market has rules around it. It is very opaque. It's not a transparent market. So I wanted to look at those things and just analyze and question government about why it doesn't analyze this great experiment we've undergone in the last 40 years. So at the end of that sort of analysis, I go into, I guess, where two trends I see are crashing into each other. And one of those is the true cost of food is not included in the price on the supermarket shelf. So that is the cost of production, producing that food, and the cost to the natural capital is not included in the price of food. And you can have all sorts of debates about whether people can afford the true cost of food. That's a completely connected, but that's another argument. But at the same time, we've got these markets, these eaters, these companies that control a lot of supply chains saying, we want you to look after the landscape, be on top of your animal welfare, you know, show transparency in all of your processes. And we want you to do it while producing, you know, a litre of milk for $1 and a loaf of bread for $3.
Most Aussies will remember the milk price wars, which began in 2011 and lasted 8 years as the major supermarkets dropped milk prices to as low as $1 per litre, or about $2.80 per gallon. There are many angles to the story, but it's indicative of the pressures to keep the price of grocery store staples low and the impact of those pressures on farmers. And Gabby is asking, if consumers want cheap food, how do we factor in the cost of production, let alone the cost of natural capital and social license?
So I guess where I land is really questioning philosophically how we value landscape and how we value the communities and people that look after landscape, including Indigenous people, which are a really important part of this whole kind of argument about how we look after land in Australia. And the thing that surprised me, I guess, was, you know, people like Ken Henry, the head of Treasury for a long time, Alan Schwartz, big hedge fund trader that's really looking at and questioning, you know, whether capitalism is broken and ends up saying outright in our interview, capitalism is broken. We don't value the things that are important to us and will take us forward. So it became quite a philosophical book in the end, I think. You pull a thread of a farm and you end up in fundamental questions about how we want to organize society.
It's great you bring up Ken Henry. We actually just had him on the podcast and you know, he's been talking about valuing natural capital for a while now, and you know, some people are listening, and I think the momentum is increasing. When do you think the ideas that he's talking about and that you're talking about here will actually become part of mainstream agriculture and everyday farming, you know, let alone what consumers can actually see?
I think it's already starting. In some ways, it's hard to see because the more visible voices in ag that you see often on social media, and a lot of the people I talk to purely because they're really interested in policy and how things work and question the system or love the system. You know, they have opinions. I think a large portion of agriculture still, you know, is head down, bum up, trying to just get through the day. And I don't think people in the kind of consumer sphere are well aware of it, but I think it will happen more. It interests me, you know, someone's got to pay for it in the end, right? Mm. So either the farmer pays, the environment pays, the consumer pays, or the government pays, or a combination of all of those, plus the private markets. So I think it won't be a sort of simple, I don't see it shaking down into this simple, clear system where it will be either all government or all private markets. I think it'll be a messy confluence of different models. The main thing that worries me, though, is the verification aspects. And this is a political perspective. If you get into a space where consumers don't trust that farmers are doing the work of improving environments and they can't see that transparent information, then you get into sports rorts territory, which in Australia was, you know, about basically paying money for jam based on where your political electorate lies. So that's the thing that really worries me about this space.
That's a kind of a useful segue into ag tech. I worry in these conversations that I run the risk of being a techno-optimist of, you know, tech will solve all these problems and we'll just decrease the costs and then no one has to pay, because obviously that's not the answer. But you do highlight the role of tech and innovation in your book, and especially around how it can help Australia to reach net zero emissions by 2050.
Yeah, well, I mean, I interviewed you obviously for the book, and there was a real point to that, because I think what worries me most about my perspective and my view is it always comes from the fractured end of the industry, because journalists by nature focus on the breakage points or the holes. And so I was worried I was a little kind of more pessimistic than maybe the average person would be in considering agriculture. And so I think the thing that I took from, you know, our conversation and conversations with other people is really there is that optimism. And I think of my own personal experience. We have three kids. I suspect none of them will come back to the farm, but one of them is particularly interested in tech and is doing computer science and maths at uni at the moment. And the only way that we can get him interested in the farm is when we talk about tech and talk about what's possible. And so that to me is a real kind of personal insight into what might spark people's interest in the future that don't necessarily come at it from the old kind of multi-generational farm family perspective. And the other thing is that I think I learned was that a whole lot of people can be involved in ag for different reasons. And often we make a big song and dance about multi-generational farmers. Ag tech to me is such a great way into the industry for people like my son, who might not be interested in the old kind of ways of that his family has been doing things for a couple of generations, but really kind of disrupting the system in a positive way. I'm really excited about that. I don't think ag tech can solve everything. It's like a tool, right? I think you might have even said that in the book. But I think it's really exciting. And the thing I learned about ag tech that I took away was that we often, or government particularly, thinks of ag tech as a separate industry to say ag or whatever it is, health, education, but its applications spread right across all of those, every area. And so I think it's a massive opportunity for Australia because we've got such brains here, but it worries me that the government don't recognise the capacity of that in agriculture because we still think of agriculture in very traditional ways in Australia. So tech to me is one of those industries that I would embed in ag if I was the Queen of Australia as a sort of standalone expertise and always refer to it and think of it when doing ag policy work because I just think it's a no-brainer.
What else would you do if you were Queen of Australia?
If I was Queen of Australia, I would have a national backyard plan. I would think about land in terms of national strategy and agriculture in terms of national security and work out, you know, like you do with your backyard. I know where my veggie garden's going. I know where my compost is going. I know where my gravel pit goes. I know the nice bits where I bring guests for lunch. I would have that for Australia because I think we've had a lot of really interesting and good policy institutes and some really interesting and fantastic reports. One of those was National Outlook by Ken Henry and David Thodey, where they actually make the point about, you know, what you need for land management if you want Australia to sort of leap ahead as opposed to status quo, which I think they call slow decline. You know, that's the kind of two trajectories that we can think about. Like we're at this really strategic point now, I think. The government's starting to change. So now's the time, I think, to think about, you know, an Australia-wide land usage plan and I guess supercharging local communities. I think the pandemic has shown us that we really need robust local and regional supply chains as well as the global supply chains.
And what would a national backyard plan be these days without soil carbon? Gabby says that the growing interest in carbon sequestration is yet another example of why a national land usage or backyard plan is desperately needed.
Because there will be competition. We've seen in the past competition for things like, say, mining and prime ag land, say, on the Liverpool Plains was the most notable example to me where you have these kind of dumb fights. Should I put a coal mine here or should I use this incredible land to grow food? Don't have to think about that one for very long. But carbon sequestration projects will also be into the mix, and we're seeing that happening now in the, I think it's the renewable energy zone. There's a lot of movement and excitement there about energy production. We're going to have to work out how we're going to do all of this because you put a carbon sequestration program next to it or overlay it over the top of a local community and you're going to have political angst. So I think that's why we need more sort of strategy, more foresight in a kind of regional plan that prepares local communities not only for the changes that happen, because change is hard in some communities, but also the opportunities are there, the opportunities and the jobs that come with that. I'm just asking the questions. I don't have all the solutions. But there are a whole lot of smart people out there. There are a whole lot of reports lying in bottom drawers that have some of these solutions. And I think aggregating that stuff and looking at the industry, agriculture, with tech embedded in it would be just such a no-brainer in terms of supercharging not just the industry but the rural and regional communities that often rely on the industry.
What's it been like for you to come in and ask some of these questions? Like, and on one hand, you can say they're harmless. I'm just asking the question. And on another hand, it's, you know, you're challenging and questioning some of how it's been. I mean, just what's it been like for you coming in and asking some of these questions, not having that background?
Well, I think it gives, having no background in it, gives me license to ask what seem like simple and dumb questions. So, you know, how did we think this is going to work? Why is it, for example, that farmers maybe get advice from input suppliers that also sell them things? why do, you know, processing and businesses further down the supply chains reach back? Do we think that's a good thing? The thing that scared me most was that, like, we turn around in 10 or 20 years' time and go, oh, wow, we really stuffed that up. Or maybe we lost opportunities that we could have made decisions on right now and had a more connected policy. And I am seriously coloured by, I guess, covering all these elections where the only policy debates I see ahead of the elections is how many roads, bridges and dams we have in regional Australia, without any nuance around what communities actually need, not just in terms of infrastructure, but in terms of ideas to keep communities vibrant.
One of the challenging issues that you take on head on and that technology obviously has a role in is around corporatization and disruption that kind of comes from that. What's your prediction for farming in Australia? Is, you know, the mid-sized family farm that you talked about fading away, and is that necessarily a bad thing? I know we sort of tend to romanticize family farms in a way that I'd probably argue is not exactly connected to reality.
Yes. Yeah. I think we do romanticize. And I think from the research that I did and talking to big corporate farmers like Ed Peter at Duxton, there's a real bullishness for agriculture that has not, I haven't seen in the last couple of decades, and I don't think that's an accident. In Australian history, since white settlement, I think, you know, we started with squatters. So we started with the big model, the big kind of industrial scale farming model, and various land acts have tried to break those up and had this kind of romanticised idea of a yeomanry on the land that would charge not only export markets, but also they talked about it in terms of democratization of land or creating communities, creating society. So I think there's definitely a romanticization of the middle family farmer. I guess the thing that worries me is if this trend to corporatization stays, and I think it will stay. I think there's definitely, you know, with a population projection of about 10 billion by 2050, it will definitely stay. There's massive global demand for food. Land is, in Australia particularly, is at scale, and so is corporate ready. There will be succession issues for family farms, particularly as the land prices, rural land prices, are going through the roof. Dividing up the family farm gets harder and harder as those prices rise. So for all of those reasons, I think that trend to the big will continue.
Just changing tax a little bit, we were really interested to read in the book about this trend around food tribes and sort of food as identity. I'm curious whether you see this as just a fad, something young people are involved in now but will go away. You mentioned that as a young person, you spent your money on clothes for your identity, and others have tribes around music choices, or maybe in my word, around the next iPhone launch. Is this food tribe thing just a fad, or something that could actually have an impact on the system?
I think it'll have an impact on the system. I was fascinated by Mike Lee, who's a food futurist. And, you know, the description of the food tribes where people determine their identity according to what they eat, I think resonates with a lot of people. We all know people who are very prescriptive about what they eat and why they choose to eat what they eat. So I don't think that will be going away. The thing that struck me about it was so close to politics, you know, this idea of identity being connected to your emotional level, to your gut, literally, I found fascinating, and that you can make decisions just based on how you feel about something, whereas we always assume it's much more intellectually driven. And I guess that goes to, you know, values, what your values are. The other thing that interested me about that, about Mike Lee's work, is that work with farmers and how to get more diversity onto their farms by using products that speak to consumers with those values, that are buying products on those values. And I don't see that going away. You would answer this question better than me, but maybe the markets are there for that in the US. I can't see that sort of example happening here where, you know, if a big food company comes along and says, you know, to a bunch of farmers, how do we make this work for what you want to grow that suits your land and suits your microclimate? And we create a product, in this case, crackers, that reflects the crop rotations in your area that best suit your soil and your land. Do you see it scaling like that here?
Yeah, I mean, it's super challenging, right? And whether it comes from the here's what we should be growing and therefore here's how we design a supply chain to enable that, or more on the other end of here's what consumers want, and consumers, as you've said, are actually very disconnected from the fact of that we even have crop rotations or that seeds are planted with equipment or any number of things in agriculture. And so I think it's more likely to come from the consumer side and what they perceive to be valuable. Just a quick example, I was sitting at MIT this week and talking to some students, and this gentleman spoke about his business where he's sourcing from local fishers in the Northeast area and across the US and trying to scale up a marketplace to sell their fish and the different bycatch and things direct to consumers. And the students had questions around like, well, why is it so expensive? Because you say that you want to make this accessible, but you're, you know, 2x the price of Whole Foods even. And he was saying, well, you know, Whole Foods is owned by Amazon. And so they're actually positioned as this high-end market, but they're able to keep costs down. And until we have that scale, we actually can't influence their production practices at all. We have to take what we get and try to change the consumer side, which is really hard. And so we just got right into this tension of who has the ability to have carrots and sticks and to do so in a way that resonates with consumers, but actually matches what are the realities of production or harvesting or whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me because, you know, I keep hitting this wall of, well, you're talking about, you know, consumers taking more interest in where their food comes from and paying for more of the cost of production if you do indeed want outcomes, environmental outcomes. And it always gets down to the fact that there are a portion of people who can't afford that and want to buy the cheapest product. And who are we to say they can't buy that? But where I always land on it is, well, you know, that's a cost to someone. So is this a cross subsidy or how is that going to work?
I mean, it's exactly the challenge, right? So, and even my personal journey sort of came from the big is bad and we need these local options. And then I ended up in a supermarket totally paralyzed by what you could buy because the small companies didn't have sustainable packaging or, you know, the technologies to enable the transparency. And so it was just marketing. And so did you believe them? And then, well, how much does it cost? And then the nutrition facts. And like one of the powerful things of these big companies is that they can invest in the underlying infrastructure to do things like bring transparency and to pay living wages when they so choose. And hopefully they do so more. And so I guess I've come full circle to the benefits of scale when they can choose to invest in, or when they do choose to invest in some of these sustainability attributes. And where I get a little bit of hope is in some of the institutional investor pressures that are coming onto these companies around task force for climate disclosure or science-based target initiatives and things like this, where it has to move beyond just greenwashing and what the foundation does on the side to truly moving the needle. And that's causing them to say, well, how are we going to work with farmers? And do we need to provide inputs? And how do we fill the gaps in extension and really kind of roll up their sleeves to get involved in changing the system? And I think that's starting to be pretty exciting.
Yeah. And the other thing that interests me is the recognition of large companies that, you know, they need that social license. And any examples where they might say environmental services is a great example. A small to mid farmer is always going to get killed on scale when it comes to selling environmental services. Whereas if you've got scale, you've got massive capacity to change the environmental outcomes on the land. And will there be, and I think there's already starting to be now, partnerships where a big company can help a bunch of smaller companies provide that, get that scale. And the other place where that might land in my view, and I think there is a sort of co-op model starting is that a kind of co-op where a bunch of small to mid-sized farmers get together and use the group and the scale to get through the complexities of environmental service contracts, which is going to be a big thing, I think. You know, there's a lot of chatter in the industry that I hear, particularly down the kind of small to medium end, about like how do we sign a 20-year contract? How do we know what happens if we go into a roaring drought? How will we be able to say that our soil carbon is sustained? Or what happens if a bushfire when it comes through, you know, a tree lot that we've signed all this carbon over for? They're the real worries in the industry that I hear about. Because if you're one farmer with one employee and you're trying to get through everything in the day, that's the hard bit.
Sure. Yeah, 100%. And I do believe big companies will have the resources to present it as a more holistic option. You know, here's the various practices around increasing soil organic matter that might help you sell credits, but by the way, have a 10x uptick on just productivity and longevity because of that gain in soil carbon or examples like that. So I definitely see potential there. I want to ask you about the farm, kind of some closing thoughts here, but I do have one more question just to change tacks again. We're speaking now just after International Rural Women's Day, and you did interview some really innovative female ag leaders in this book. So I wanted to ask about the changing role of women in farming. And actually, in your book, you describe them as change makers. Why is that so?
I just think they approach things differently, that the women I spoke to just had a different approach, and I think aren't bound by some of the conservative culture that men, in my experience, have been more affected by. So they're looking outside, they're trying to think of new ways to do things. They're hyper aware of the culture they're in, like they're very observant about the culture they're in and how they need to change that. That's why we have diversity, right? That's why we go for diversity targets and things like that in other industries, is to bring a different set of eyes onto a problem and say, oh, how can I see my way through this? Maybe there's something else I can do here.
To wrap here, Gabby, where did you land? Like, is there an answer to the question, what's the best way to farm in the future in a way that is productive but also sustainable?
Well, no, that's too big a question. But I think diversity is one of my keys. So, you know, people are arguing about which system is best. And I think in some ways it wastes a lot of energy saying, you know, this system is best, or, you know, there's the whole kind of rise of the term regenerative farming is something we haven't touched on. There's a lot of energy wasted, I think, on, you know, arguments about which system is better. But I think diverse systems are good, and we're going to have to work out how we resolve this kind of tension between, you know, on the one hand, when droughts happen, politicians come out and say, we want rural communities, we want mum and dad farmers, we want all of this. And on the other hand, we're saying we need scale, we need global capital, we need investment. Surely we need a diversity of all of these models. You know, we have to acknowledge the natural capital and the environmental costs of farming and do it better. And I think people are, but it has to be, when I think of the farm models around here, it has to be safe to fail, and reform has to happen with some understanding of the culture and the system, the farming systems that people are working in. Otherwise, you just won't get people to move. You know, it is a conservative culture. Like, you see the innovative end, and maybe I see the more restricted conservative end, but somehow there has to be an accommodation between the two.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Huge thanks to Gabby Chen, whose latest book is called Why You Should Give an F About Farming. It's well worth a read. For links to any of the resources we mentioned in this episode, visit our website, agtechsowhat.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And if you like what you hear, please tell a friend and leave us a review. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.